This is channel one over. This is channel one over. This is Monday the 6th of May, and it's my first full day on Moby Dick. This is channel one over. My first Monday the 6th of May, my first full day on Moby Dick. And this is an interesting story. I had the papers from last week, an essay on Wednesday, and a half-hour quiz over several books on Friday. Now, I had got into the essays and the quizzes, and I had got the wrong idea. I saw that they had not weren't even close to Usher, and they didn't take Dimmesdale in his strength. They wanted to take the crazy part of it. And I was prepared to work them over. And then between today, Monday, the 6th, and Wednesday, I found out that they were trying to do, had in mind to do, what I tried to do on today, on Monday. That is, they wanted to make a statement about Ishmael and work it out. And their skill, their method, their technique wasn't up to their intention. Now, at the beginning of an hour, I see I'm laying out the reading of Whitman on Monday, the very first thing before I get into Moby Dick or Ishmael. I lay out the reading for Whitman. Wouldn't even read it solid. You can tell as you go along. I'd like for you to read about 50 pages and all. I mean, just for your particular purpose. Some of that is beginning about his ancestry. You might be innocent, you might not. The section of the poem, or one volume of poems, is called Drum Taps. That's on page, what did I say? 223. Now there again, you see, I wouldn't want you to read all of those drum taps if you wanted to. I don't think you need to. I'd read some of the short ones, I believe. I'll specify some later. Song of the Open Road is, it's not a long poem. It's a little longer than these. I'd read all of that. Now, this is all fairly, you can get into this, these three. But now, preface in 1855 and Song of Myself are a little rough going. I don't think either one will be with your background. I think you can work your way through them, but it'll be working your way through them. And what you do in those two, preface 1855, see, the Song of Myself is the first thing you published. That was the great surprise to the world. That's where he burst into print and became a, he wasn't recognized then, but he had raised that now, that Song of Myself, I imagine that's first thing in your book. Is that right? Song of Myself? That's a long collection. Song of Myself, now that, it was altered a good bit, but as it first appeared, it's one of the great productions of our country. And that was printed at the same time, preface 1855. And then was revised a little bit in 1856 in a way we'll talk about. And over here, Lilacs, When Lilacs Last, and The Dooryard Bloom, and The Cradle Endlessly Rocking, that's two of his great poems, fine poems. So much of Whitman, you see, is not poetry. It's not much of anything, so much of it. But you can tell the difference as you get into it. I want to do the work today, but I want you to talk back. Those two points I brought up open up, I think, the Moby Dick, like nothing else,
those the statement in that my Yale College, my Harvard is a whaling ship, and the signs of the time, and it is in the common, the commonplace, and also in the common individuals. Now that's in there. Now let me approach it this way, and let you kind of make an inventory of yourself. Now what you see, or what I see, and in your class essay, what it seemed to me that you saw in it. Now that depends, you see, partly on your categories, the terms in which you think. Now, Ishmael sees one thing. Ishmael sees everything. Now, look at Jonah. I'm not sure. You see, Jonah's not developed. But from the little glimpse we have of Jonah, he also had this voyage, you see, and he's one of the figures of world, one of the world figures in fiction. I'm not sure what Jonah saw. I'm simply not certain at all what Jonah saw. Now, I wouldn't want to open or close your minds to that. But I see no indication at all that Jonah saw much of anything. Or I'd put it this way, his vision, his view is focused. It's a very strong light on what he does see. Now you see, what I want you to do, I want you to think of yourselves. Now what do you see as you go through this book? And I'm not sure that you'd see any more of this book than you see of your companions that you live with. Now, in Poor Richard, don't forget now that as a group, we tended to fall into the historical trap of thinking of prudence as persistence, of a sort of dogged persistence where we say a fella just keeps trying, you see, as if there were any merit in that. There is just no merit in just dogged persistence. Now that's certainly not the Franklin that we saw at Passy in those little passages, you see, that I read to you from the Frenchman's book. Now, you see, in the Scarlet Letter, I fall into that same pitfall, and I think we all do, that we see one Hester we don't see. I'm not sure that we see Hawthorne's Hester. That picture of her, you see, as she emerges from the darkness of that jail. You see, now I won't use adjectives. We still haven't resolved that. I don't know what's in your mind when you think of Hester on that occasion. I'm not sure that you've seen her, actually seen her yet. It looks like one or two little passages in the book have stamped her past recovery. We see her performing those acts of mercy. And you see, Emerson tells you that that's a virtue, yes, but it's a rather low one. Philanthropy. Philanthropy. Now, in their values, you understand? I see I think we are all in the same boat here, and what I think you can do in this reading is to come to grips with this reading and see more in it, and you see yourselves more clearly than in any other reading you've ever done. Now, I'm tired of talking, you talk. It depends on your categories, yes. Let's just to start. Now, you see, Melville says there in that chapter, if then, that's knights and squires, to meanest mariners I shall hereafter ascribe high qualities. To meanest mariners, just plain common soldiers, you might say. But now he approaches that just a little different, you see, back where he's in the chapter on the ship. He's talking about you see, the Quakers becoming whaling sailors. That blends a Quaker upbringing with the adventure of whaling. And then, as Ishmael says, a man of greatly superior natural force, he learns to think untraditionally and independently, and he learns what he calls a bold and nervous, lofty language. Now that's Ishmael himself. We don't hear Hester's language. We don't know what she had. Let me read you just a passage or two from Sorrel. I think that I love society as much as most, and am ready enough to fasten myself like a bloodsucker on any interesting person. Now, that's not his terms. Now, this is a passage where he talks about having three chairs. One inconvenience, let me see how this works out. One inconvenience, open that door. One inconvenience I sometimes experience in so small a house, the difficulty of getting to a sufficient distance from my guest where we began to utter the big thoughts in big words. Now, did he talk like this? You want room for your thoughts to get into sailing trim and run a course or two before they make that port. First perception I ever had of what they're talking about was up at, I told you that, White Springs. One of the only big hotel left there. It was late one afternoon, and the owner of the hotel that hauled that countryside up there was there with some of his old friends who'd been stopping there for years. They were sitting on that long veranda, you see, in those cane-bottom chairs. You see, they were all looking out. And they, you see, it's just like I'm talking to you, but we're sitting alongside. I'm talking out into the air. And if I just turn towards you, I don't have to talk near as loud, you see. But now there's the sound that they heard. I'm not sure just what sort of reading we are taught to do. You see, now, speed reading won't get this, and if you translate this into speed reading, you won't get that. You won't get what he wrote. It's untranslatable, you know. I was going to read you now just this one bit here. And here he comes, you see. This is that fine passage I discovered with you all. As for men, they will hardly feel one anywhere. Now, that is precisely the same thing that Emerson said in Signs of the Time, and that Melville says in the passage in Knights and Squires. As for men, they will hardly feel one anywhere. You see, society, solitude, and all that's not the point. I had more visitors while I lived in the woods than any other time. I mean, I had some. I met several there under more favorable circumstances than I could anywhere else. You know, I just can't, that just haunts my mind. And I see people in such unfavorable circumstances. I just killed yesterday afternoon, just killed it. We all just tied down, couldn't get away, and we said the most trivial thing. We're just waiting for the time to pass. Just caught. Now, you've been caught like that. I don't get caught much like that now. I'm forewarned, yes. My only comment on that is that you don't look cramped now. Now, look at this Canadian woodchopper. I just read you a few passages. Who would come to my lodge this morning? But a true Homeric or Paphlagonian man, a Canadian, a woodchopper and postmaker, who can hold 50 posts in a day, who made his last supper on a woodchuck, which his dog caught. And he too has heard of Homer. You see, the priest taught him to read some of these things and translate a passage. And now I must translate to him. While he holds the book, Achilles reproved to Patroclus for his sad countenance. Why are you in tears, Patroclus? Like a young girl. You see, that's one of those marvelous passages. And he gives it. And the woodchopper says, oh, that's good. Now, he has a great bundle of white oak bark under his arm for a sick man gathered this Sunday morning. And he says, I suppose there's no harm in going after such a thing today. To him, Homer was a great writer, though what his writing was about, he didn't know. He a more simple and natural man, it would be hard to find. Vice and disease, which cast such a somber moral hue over the world, seemed to have hardly any existence for him. You say, why does he bring that in? You see, the world is concerned, is involved in vice and disease. Except in Thoreau. And Emerson, Melville, he was about 28 years old and had left Canada and his father's house a dozen years before to work in the States and earn money to buy a farm with at last, perhaps in his native country. He was cast in the coarsest mold. A stout but sluggish body, yet gracefully carried, with a thick sunburnt neck, with dark, bushy hair, and dull, sleepy blue eyes, which were occasionally lit up with expression. He wore a flat, gray cap, a dingy, wool-colored coat, and cowhide boots. He was a great consumer of meat, usually carrying his dinner to his work a couple of miles past my house, for he chopped all summer in a tin pail. cold meats, often cold woodchucks, and coffee in a stone bottle which dangled by a string from his belt. Now, you know, as I read that, just that little taste of it, seems so simple. And yet, to read that yourselves, you have to have a complex mentality. You have to have a critical appreciation of what Emerson and Thoreau and the others have been talking about. See, now there's your category that I'm talking about. Now, to me, I don't know. Now, how does that work with Melville's characters? The mates and the harpooners and the... Who else? Ms. Hussey and all of them. Think of it as a piece. But now you see, Thoreau did this a generation before Melville did his. Do you see any continuation, you might say? Yes. That's right. That's right. Now, is this the American Scholar that Emerson's talking about? No. No. Not quite. Not quite. The scholar is still an educated man. He's not a genius, but he's still an educated man. Now, these are not. Yes. That's right, as they excel in their particular line. Well, now that's what Franklin said. He who, poor Richard said, he who hath a trade hath an estate. Not quite the same, though, is it? But they had one. Now, don't hesitate to talk. Go ahead. Now, let me run through. Now let me see. I carry several train of thought in my mind. I'm thinking now of all this what Ishmael sees. Now this is his Yale College and his Harvard. Now he has all of those things. Now look, I don't have this systematically. I sat down a while ago while I was waiting to come into town, and I just jotted these down. Do you see any good humor in Melville and Ishmael? Some of it, I won't stop to read that. Some of it is just great good humor. Now, you remember those clashes between Peleg and Ishmael? In a way, that's a sort of a Homeric quality where they taunt each other. I don't know. I'm just trying to find the proper view of that. Now he sees those customs, as we'd call them, like the GAM, where the whaling ships meet, one that's been out for a year or two and one of them's just fresh out, and they exchange information and letters. You remember the GAM? Now that's what Ishmael sees. Now, this is what I'm thinking about now. In your mind, what do you accumulate to take the place of that? When you go home at night, you see, you don't go home, you go to residence hall, and you put up a lot of stuff. You see, it's not quite right. But you just imagine it now. If you go home at night, what would be your GAM, your observation, you see? What would be your budget of news? I'm not sure that I pick up information like that. Now, in this world outside ourselves, do you remember that picture of the whales grazing in a meadow of brit? B-R-I-T, they still do that, you know, of brit. Now, you see, that's a common sight for them. Now, that's the world outside. And it just makes me wonder what sort of mental furnishings I have, and when I come home from the day's journey, you see, what sort of game do I take out of my bag? Do you remember, I didn't ask you to read this far, but what he calls the monkey rope. Queequeg is doing something on the whale's head. And the thing is, it's the sea's rough and the thing's hitting against, you see, it weighs 2 or 3 tons, or 20 tons, I don't know how much, and hitting against the ship, and then the sharks are working on it. And they tie this rope around Ishmael, and he holds Queequeg there to keep him from falling off. And what he says is, while I jerked him now and then from between the whale and the ship, which would threaten to jam him, I saw that this situation of mine was the precise situation of every mortal that breathes. All of us, you see, depend on some sort of lifeline like that. If the baker doesn't make the bread, we don't fast so well. If the electricity goes off, you see, but this illustrates it. Now here's the spirit of Byron. Now see, this carried in men's minds for centuries on that masthead. I don't know whether you got to that or not, did you? Childe Harold not unfrequently perched himself upon the masthead, you read that, of some luckless, disappointed whale ship. And in moody phrases ejaculates, roll on. Now that's one of the famous words from Childe Harold. Those deep and dark blue oceans roll. Now there's your moody young man, you see, who's on that ship. Now, you remember he goes into the anatomy of the whale? I remember one little part. He's telling where the ears and the eyes are. And he says you could look all day if you didn't know where to look, and you would never find his ear. It's hardly a slit. I forget just what it was. Now, that's the anatomy. That's the anatomy of it. Now, you remember the customs that he observes? Like the cabin table where they eat? That custom. Now, what did you make of the chapter called Cetology? Huh? Yeah, you've got 100 years advantage on it, yeah? Well, Emerson warns you against the scientific method, which is classification. But now Ishmael's not afraid of it. He makes those statements, you see, about the whale. What is one of them? To be short, then, a whale is a spouting fish with a horizontal tail. Now look what his comment is. There you have him. However contracted that definition is a result of expanded meditation. Now that's not the scientific method, but he's not afraid of that. Now I don't think Thoreau cared for that. This world with action in it. Now this is the first lowering, he calls it. A short rushing sound leaped out of the boat. It was the dotted iron of Queequeg. Then all in one welded commotion came an invisible push from astern, while forward the boat seemed striking on a ledge. The sail collapsed and exploded. A gush of scalding water shot up nearby. Something rolled and tumbled like an earthquake beneath us. The whole crew were half suffocated as they were tossed helter-skelter into the white curdling cream of the squall. That's in the little boat, you see. Squall, whale, and harpoon had all blended together, and the whale, merely grazed by the iron, escaped. Now, you say that action is commonplace. It's not, it doesn't happen all the time, but there's an action that they live in. And when they don't live in it, they recall it and live in it in that way. So now look. Now, what sort of world is it, you see, that Ishmael sees? And then the content of Melville's story. The content of it, you see, is solid experience. And you see, none of it imagined or cooked up or invented. It's almost like straightforward historical information in the content. Now, pretty soon, you see, you're going to leave that. And the whole world would just have a sort of mental existence. They don't live in that experience. As a matter of fact, now I don't know, you can test yourself on this. Do you have experiences yourself? And then do you remember your experiences? And talk about your experiences? Now, you see, for Ishmael, his experience is the content of his mind. Now, you talk. Do you feel, now you see, there's one of the Emersonian qualities, points that we talked about was some freedom, you see, of society. Do you feel that Ishmael has declared, has won some freedom from society? Well, talk about it a little bit. It's another society, yes. How would that differ from Thoreau's society that he had at Walden? About solitude in the sense of not seeing anybody. He says the only trouble with society is that it's commonly too cheap. And we don't see each other in favorable circumstances. I'm not sure that solitude is his greatest virtue. Now you say something. Just common that anyone in his position would have that feeling. But you know, you come to think about it, the first thing that would happen to me if I was on that Pequod, I couldn't do that at all. Now you see, his mind is clear all the time. And his categories don't close his mind. What? I don't know. You stated the point there, and I don't know which side I'd be on that. But I think that's a question now, to what extent can he keep his mind clear while the thing goes on? Now, let me tell you. An active mind that he had ever encountered. used to have lunch, half a dozen of them used to have lunch every week, once a week, have lunch together. And they knew each other pretty well. If I were to tell you how to lead a good life, it would just be words. I wouldn't know. But in Moby Dick, I can show you what a good life is. That is what the qualities of it are. And you see it yourself. You see it yourself, you know. Yes. I wouldn't say experience. You experience in reading this. You experience it so that you see. It picks you up short, and then you see where he is strong. And there's morality whatever in this. There's absolutely no morality in it. It's a quality of mind. Now, you see, the people who read St. Paul don't pursue St. Paul. They think of him in terms of theology. They try to translate straightforward actions such as you see in Ishmael, and you can do that. You can translate Ishmael's experience into theology if you want to. I hope you never want to. I could translate this into morality, but I hope I never succumb. Well, now, let me tell you, one of my old friends used to say that this time, I haven't read the whole thing. I've just been dipping into it with you, and I just haven't been able to get my mind on anything else. It just sort of picks me up, and you know, I think I'd do better handling my cattle out there. Now, let me tell you, this is a class in the university. You'll be given a grade in here. I want you to feel considerable freedom, but I want you to push yourselves into working out categories that will determine Ishmael's viewpoint and work that out. Now, when you get into Whitman, I want you to feel considerable freedom. But I want you to be categorical to this extent that you see where he's talking about the same thing that Ishmael's talking about and that the others talking about. Now, you're going to enjoy this. Just bring Whitman with you next time.
This is 460 on the dial, and that's the end of the discussion on Monday, the 6th of May, that first full session that I had with him on Ishmael. And I see now that it's my approach to Ishmael here is that Ishmael is a point of view that they can use themselves. That is, he sees more than they do because he has those Emersonian categories. And I wasn't too easy with it, but at least that's what it was in my mind. Now, this is the Wednesday on the 8th of May following that. After I had read the test.
When does that make you quiet? It's just Wednesday. You're not quiet. Just this week hasn't quieted you just by Wednesday, has it? Why is it quiet? Everybody. No, I don't have any money. Is that what you mean?
No. Did you reach any other?
No. 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 I haven't kept up with Chester Ferguson. I'm ashamed I haven't. Why don't you come by the office and catch me up on that?
I don't think you want to hear what you're.
Well, I'm pretty well hardened to what goes on.
And the rest of the board agrees
that you ought to go and join the Sorbonne. They're having a good time now. No, I'd like to know what's going on. I don't know. to you. I was a little sharp with you. I'd been reading along in your papers, and I wasn't, very well impressed. The points I was laying for you, and last night I started it, and this morning I finished it. I looked back through your papers to find some good negative examples, you see, if I could work you over. And I got into your papers a little better. And there's more there, I think, than I thought at first. And I'd have to change my whole tack. Now, let me tell you the background of this. Now, you see, last week on Monday, we came in here and just sort of turned the pages. We didn't say anything. You didn't say anything. I didn't say anything. It was worth hearing. Then on Wednesday, you had the first shot at Moby Dick, the book, Ishmael. But there's been no indoctrination. It's your subject. And then on Friday, I gave you that other writing. Now, so my first shot at it was on Monday. And I think you listened a little bit to that. But now, you see, what was short Monday, I had the wrong attitude towards your papers. And if I'd had these papers in better shape, what I said Monday would have been a great deal better. Now, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to spend 10 or 15 minutes and work from your papers. And I don't have them quite ready to give them back to you. I'll give them back to you Friday. Let you see them as I've been doing. And then I'll have them in the office whenever you come over there. You see, now you see, I was a little impressed or depressed with your comments on Usher. So I kind of had to forget about that. I was going to read a passage or two, but I won't do it. Usher doesn't fare well in the very few papers who wrote on it. Usher has an agony or anxiety or something like Dimmesdale. Now, you see, there's one thing that you never mention about Dimmesdale is that great power he has. You simply never seem to be tongue-tied. Your hands are behind you when it comes to saying the important things. You know, you can say something mechanical and unessential about anything or any subject. Now, Usher is one of the men of great power. And Poole, well, I don't get a thing about his power, just get his anxiety. Now look, in Ahab, you see, there's a superficial resemblance to Chillingworth. And you see, I just love to sit around and talk with you now on this, but I want to push a little farther. As a superficial resemblance they have, and oppose a man, what's his name, Fortunato, in that revenge, what you call that obsession for revenge against the white whale. See, that's not the important thing. The important thing is what drove him to it. But no one mentions that. Now, that's what was bothering me, see, last time. Irene, I sort of mad at you. But now I'll take it back, and I won't be mad at you. And I'll be a little bit more positive. Now, let me show you. Ishmael is the person that you are prepared for. As for Ishmael, it is the struggle of a young man to get away from the rigors and confinements of the civilized world, and so Melville, in a very stylistic manner, that's not the right word, introduces the character Ishmael, something to be like, longs to be like Queequeg. Yes, yes. Now that's a good statement. That's a good statement. Ishmael immediately becomes attached to Queequeg. The giant island native who is a harpooner by trade is a savage from the beginning, but he has a quality of a human being that Ishmael longs for. That is, Queequeg is truly alive and lives for his life. Now let me show you. You see what it is. He is, let me see if this is the right place. He is concerned with experience and learning about something that has a dramatic force behind it. Something that, now I left out a good bit here. I'm just getting to the point. Something that smells of life. His philosophy concerning action was a common one at the time the book was written. It was espoused by Carlyle, who was a friend of Emerson. And some trace of it can be found in both Emerson and Thoreau. Now let me show you what he does. He gets the idea, but it fizzles out in a metaphor. He's looking for something that smells of life. That's a metaphor, no information in it. And then goes off into Carlyle and something else and leaves out the whole book. You see, your material in here, Ishmael's material, is not in here. Now let's try again. Now Ishmael seems to be Thoreau adventuring to his Walden, the sea. Now all three papers have the same thing in mind, as I understand it. He feels trapped by society and wishes to escape the hindrances of society, experience life outright. For him, this means going to sea. I've already said that. For Thoreau, it meant going to Walden. Then he quotes, Ishmael is like Emerson in that Ishmael steps to his own drummer. That's still a metaphor. He desires to pursue life without the restrictions imposed by society, which demands that we not live in the present. And he quotes again, to me, Ishmael is living in the present by going to sea, but like Thoreau, must return to attend the other items. Ishmael has a sense of inquiry necessary for a person to live in the present. Now you see, he goes on and he develops it, the idea, a little better than the other two papers, but still got no information. Now, I'll let you grade me. Last time, I tried to say the same thing. And this is the way I did it, and I fumbled a good bit. I started off by saying, bringing back the two points that I had said to you before, that the idea that opens the book most of all is to think of it as his schooling, his year of college in Harvard. And he learns in that what a person would learn in school. Of course, it looks so different. And then I brought out, I just merely restated it, didn't go into it, you know, one of the signs of the time, the interest in the commonplace, and also the common person. And then I tried to speak to you about Ishmael. That Ishmael, you see, and Jonah, Ishmael and Jonah. that I was in doubt, I am in doubt. What Jonah sees in the world, I am in doubt, serious doubt, as to what Jonah sees in the world. But now what Ishmael is prepared for, the experience he's prepared to have, and what he's prepared to see in it, is all here. And it's extraordinary. And this is what I said to you. He sees or feels or experiences, and I didn't give you an example of this, there's several awfully fine examples, this great good humor. Now, you see what I'd like for you to do, now what I'd want to do is bring a case of it. Just bring a case of it. Then I said to you, another thing that Ishmael is capable of doing, his mind is open to the extent that he can do this, that he has these clashes with Peleg. They are like the old epic taunts between the warriors. And I said to you, I had also confronted the captains of boats, but that I was always intimidated, and I couldn't maintain my side. Now, what I would do, you see, is bring it up, the point that I brought to you. I gave you the example in class where he says he wants to see something of whaling and see something of the world. And you remember what Peleg says to him? We went into that. He said, if you want to see the whaling, go look at Captain Ahab and that missing leg. And if you want to see the world, go out and look out there. And it's all water and monotonous. That's what you'll see from whaling, he said. But now, that's not out-and-out information. That's a clash, sort of between them, isn't it? How do you take that? You tell me. How do you take that? But it's not, I don't know quite the attitude to take towards that, or the word to call it. And Ishmael. Call it something, Howard. Maybe so. But he's doing it as one man another. Yeah. And it's a manly occupation. All right. Well, now you remember what I said. And you see, he's conscious of the world outside. You see, now you can go from there. What would you make of the monkey rope? You see where the boy, where Queequeg, that's over past where I asked you to read. He's over on the head, cutting it up or doing something to it, harpooner, Queequeg is. But to hold him, you see, Ishmael has that rope around him. And he jostles, he heists him up every now and then to keep the ship from keep him from getting in between the head and the ship and getting smashed. That monkey rope. Now, what would you call that? Taxi, yes. He's whaling? Is that whaling? He sees? Now you, huh? Help me out. What is that? Well, now this is what Ishmael is prepared to see. Now then, what you had in mind? Yes? Well, now talk a little bit. You just watching me flounder up here. Yeah, you state the idea, and I give some of the...
people go, the people he meets and everything. I don't think that he, there's one good quality I can say he wants. He doesn't about, he had, at first he had these bad, you know, visions of what Quigley would be like, and he didn't want to spend the night with him, but then he kept, you know, bringing the other side back into him. And this is really, I don't know, a person with this kind of attitude and this kind of thinking, why I think is a much more free person, you know, as far as the thinking.
You wouldn't rest your case with just one character. You wouldn't rest your case with just one character.
Oh, you want me to go on? Okay. Let me think. What?
He holds the case open. He holds it open. He doesn't just give you a judgment right off. A final judgment, does he?
No.
Well, don't stop there now. Follow it up. Help him out. Don't. Is he letting him flounder just like he let me?
Well, he doesn't just think he was Ahab. Like, he could really think of horrible things about this Ahab, especially after that guy on the street told him that stuff and about how mysterious, you know, his surroundings were until they got on the ship. And he really didn't think anything of it until, even after he met us, until the time when he launched it, that the boat himself with the Chinese men.
You think he kept his mind open towards Ahab?
Yeah, more or less. Until he actually, it said at one point that he was fighting down. He goes, as much as I hate to think it, I think Ahab, you know, is a tortured man. But up until that point, he kept his mind open.
Yeah, he explained especially about why Ahab might be caught in this vengeful attitude that he has, because he explained exactly what happened to Captain Ahab, and he explained how it could be understandable that a person could be like that.
Yeah.
Well, now neither one of you said a saying. No content at all in what you said. You haven't been concrete at all. Pin it down to something concrete. There he is with that bone for a leg, and what does he do? He gets out there and walks on the deck. Got that old thing stumping on the deck. And
every time it probably hurts him, every time it hurts him, he thinks about the body.
Yes, and the pin, and you know where the crew sleep. Right square there underneath that. They're just 4 feet, 6 feet or less.
Doesn't Starbuck or was it Starbuck who comes up and asks him to stop walking around on there because the crew can't sleep?
Yeah, but he only did it that one time.
That's obvious. But that's the method. That's the method. You need a certain expository method in order to work out your source. You need a certain amount of method, you see, to work out your source. You need to take a thought and work it through a large amount of information, just one little thought. And work it through a large amount of information, and that is the paper. That is your paper, you see? Just one thought, all you need. Ishmael is capable of having experiences. For one thing, he doesn't judge these characters the first thing and then discard them. He keeps it open. That'll carry you through the whole book. Be very interesting. Now, some little statements might interest more than others. That interests me. Let's talk about Whitman. In Whitman now, you just must read 10 or 20 pages of biography. You just must. I can't tell you Whitman's story. Best place I know to get it is in the Dictionary of American Biography, right over there in the college library. Good place to sit, good light, and quiet. Dictionary of American Biography. You get 10 or 15 pages on Whitman. You read the whole thing. Now, you see, Whitman was born in 1819. You need that little chronology, 1820, say. And then isn't that right? And then his poems came out in 1855, without any warning at all. Nobody knew that he was even interested in poetry. How much is 20 from 55?
35.
That's too old. He's middle-aged, you see, before he starts. He's a late learner. He had to do it himself. He had been a newspaper man, the Brooklyn Eagle. I don't know how many years he did it. I read through 2 years, 2 volumes, 2 years of it. Read all the editorials and some of the news. As a good newspaper. He wrote the editorials, and he was interested in the same thing everybody else was interested in. As far as I could see, there was no indication at all that he was a poet or even literary in his taste. Now, what else is it about Whitman? You say something. 1855, you see, is the critical date. And I'm going to tell you, he stopped that. He quit. He let that paper go. I don't remember the circumstances. And he took this overland trip. Oh, to New Orleans. Oh, he went by river steamboat and coach or whatever they had, rode a horse. I don't know, he spent a year, 18 months, and while he was there, he made a living. He sort of worked on the Picayune, and that's the name of the paper down there, Times Picayune. And they know what he wrote. I mean, they picked out things that he wrote while he was there. Now, by the time he did that, you can be sure he knew what was ahead of him. You see, he writes about America, and what he does on that trip is experience America. I see that one of the first things Mark Twain did was take this tramp. He went as a tramp printer to Cincinnati and to New Jersey and to one place or another, reading a little few books and doing things. And been a printer for a week or two, a month or two, and moving on. That's the way he got by. It's almost like hoboing. Hobo. Now that's what Ishmael did. You see, he's. I'll continue this tape from Wednesday, the 8th of May. I'm on Whitman now, on to this, onto Channel 2 right, onto Channel 2 right. This is the 8th of May on Whitman on Wednesday. And I'll continue it on Channel 2 right. This is Walden to live cheaply. Who wants to live cheap? That's not an object. See, you're judging him by common sense.